Lucian Hardy. Lucian's a faculty member here at Perimeter Institute in the Quantum Foundations Group. And 10 years ago, Lucian wrote a paper entitled Quantum Theory from Five Reasonable Axioms. And this was a very influential paper that was, I think, one of the factors that brought about this renaissance we've seen in the last 10 years in trying to derive quantum theory from axiomatic principles that Gilles talked about. And just this year, just recently, Lucian has come up with a new and improved set of axioms, and that's what he's going to tell us about now.
Thanks very much. These are the postulates. I'll go through them later in the talk once I've defined the various terms. So the title of this talk is Reformulating and Reconstructing Quantum Theory, but the real title is Reconstructing, and if I have time, which I actually almost certainly won't, Reformulating Quantum Theory. It's really two different talks that are related. So let me give a sort of biased history of Reconstruction. So I got into this under the influence of Chris Fuchs, just as Gilles did. So a number of years ago, he was giving talks where he implored people to find information theoretic reasons for the axioms of quantum theory, and that had a very strong influence on me. But they didn't actually start working on the problem until Chris and Gilles, the previous speaker, invited me to a conference or workshop in Montreal in the year 2000. As it turned out, I wasn't able to go to the conference, but nevertheless, I'd already started working on this problem, and it was too late to stop. The following year, I wrote the paper that Rob just referred to, Quantum Theory for Five Reasonable Axioms. This is for finite dimensional quantum theory. I think most people in this community are concerned with finite dimensional quantum theory for the most part. So this set of axioms were, for the most part, quite nice, I thought, except that there was one axiom which I didn't like and a lot of other people didn't like, which was the simplicity axiom. So it's not so clear what it means outside the context, but basically states are specified by the smallest number of probabilities consistent with the other axioms. I didn't like it because A, simplicity is a bad principle, and B, it's bad if an axiom necessarily refers to the other axioms in your set. And I worked on this for a very long time and made very little progress, either in proving that actually more complicated theories exist or in proving that they didn't. And then a couple of years ago, a number of papers started appearing. Dakic and Czaslaw Bruckner, who is here, came up with a beautiful argument showing how to get rid of the simplicity axiom, they replaced it with another axiom, which I'm calling here G-bit state spectrality. It's actually a very simple idea that the state for a generalized bit can be written as a sum of any state for a generalized bit can be written as a sum of some pair of distinguishable states. And in quantum theory, this is true because you can diagonalize the density matrix. In fact, the general statement is true for arbitrary dimensional systems. Luis Marzanas and Marcus Muller, who were both talking at this workshop, replaced this simplicity assumption with the assumption that all mathematically well-defined measurements are allowed for a G-bit, a generalized bit. And Gilles mentioned their postulates in his talk just now. And then also in two papers, Giulio, our organizer, Mauro, Dariano, and Paolo Perinotti, who are all here, sitting near the front, gave a different scheme of axioms. Actually, they wrote two papers. In the first paper, they provided a sort of general framework for theories where they invented this trick. I call it the CDP trick, using teleportation to get rid of the effectively to get rid of the need for a simplicity axiom. And then in a later paper, they derived quantum theory from their own set of axioms. You saw those in the previous talk. So in the reconstruction that I give, I use this trick, this beautiful trick of CDP. I probably could also have used the trick that was used by Dakic and Bruckner, and the similar trick was used by Massanas and Muller. But in the end, it turned out to be easier to use this CDP trick. There's been a lot of work recently along less related lines by various people. This is a very incomplete list. There was a conference a couple of years ago where various people presented their reconstructions of quantum theory and their attempts in this direction, which you can see it's recorded on PERSA, the Perimeter Institute recorded seminar archive. And in fact, if you go back, there's a very long history of attempts to reconstruct quantum theory, going all the way back to sort of von Neumann, these people. It's a very old subject, which has been given a new twist recently because of the ideas coming from quantum information. People following on from Chris Fuchs and others. So one of the things I should say is that there's another school of people working in Oxford, Samson Abramsky and Bob Kirker, who've developed this categorical approach to quantum theory. So far as I'm concerned, what categorical means is pictorial. So they draw pictures. And that work has been very influential in this work. Okay. So the new paper that I put on the archive a few weeks ago, so it has basically three core parts. In the first part, I lay out what I call the circuit framework. This is, as Jill was saying, if you're going to use some axioms or postulates to rederive quantum theory, you need to have some sort of background structure. This circuit framework is, I think, probably the sort of most neutral framework you can come up with for this kind of purpose. So you imagine circuits, which are basically boxes with lines drawn between them, which you can think of as representing the passages of systems. I'll explain that later. And then I have three assumptions. The first one is that circuits have probabilities associated with them. I'll explain that one later. And then there's two other assumptions. One is that non-trivial finite systems exist. What that means is that there has to exist at least one type of system which has more than one distinguishable state, more than one reliably distinguishable state, and yet is specified by a finite number of probabilities. And then the third assumption concerns, basically it gives you closed sets, your mathematical sets of states and transformations and effects. Are closed under this assumption. And I won't go into that assumption, but you can look in the paper. It's a very natural assumption. It's just a... it's more of an assumption of mathematical convenience than anything else. It allows you to help yourself to the real numbers as you would like to. So this framework that I'm describing here is very similar in many respects to the framework that was developed by Giulio, Mauro, and Paolo, the CDP framework. And also they have similar assumptions going into their framework. So those are sort of background assumptions that set up the framework. So the second part of the paper is a mathematical reformulation of quantum theory. So it turned out that in order to reconstruct quantum theory, I need some version of quantum theory that I was trying to reconstruct. And it was easier to give a reformulation of quantum theory for this purpose and then reconstruct that version of quantum theory. And then the reformulation that I give, I think, is interesting in its own by itself, even if you're not interested in reconstruction. It has a lot in common with the quantum Combs approach of, you've guessed it, Giulio, Mauro and Paolo, and also has a lot in common with the multi-time approach of Aharonov, Sandra Popescu, Lev Weidman, Jeff Tollickson. And it also has a lot in common with the general boundaries approach due to Robert Urkel. And there are two axioms in this reformulation, which, when you understand what the words mean, are equivalent to standard quantum theory. So what I'm actually going to talk about after I've introduced this circuit framework is the reconstruction of quantum theory from the five operational axioms that I had on the first slide. But first, let me just say this, since I'm giving a talk in the morning of the first day. I just wanted to say some very sort of make some very general remarks about ambitions I have for this field in general, not just within my own framework, but more generally. So I think people working in the field of quantum foundations have got to be prepared to engage with the great problems of physics. It's too often the case that people in foundation sort of retreat, that they regard their job as being more of a sort of philosophical one, to sort of come along afterwards and tidy up the mess after the great work has been done. I don't think it should be like that. I think we should be involved in the great project of theoretical physics. So we should be involved in thinking about quantum field theory, quantum gravity, especially quantum gravity, and cosmology, and all the other sort of deep and difficult problems of fundamental physics. I think we should do that partly because it's fun, but also because I think the techniques and methods that we're developing are likely to have some impact, some positive impact on those fields. If you're trying to develop new physics, it makes a lot of sense to go back to the fundamentals, to the foundations. And I think in particular, the sort of operational, informational approach that has been pursued in this particular community has great promise in that respect. So we've got to work hard. This is difficult work, and we have to actually do the work. We've got to be ambitious. We've got to be prepared to take on this challenge and change the course of physics. This, I think, is something that we have to take seriously. Okay, so let me talk about the circuit framework. So the basic object in the circuit framework is an operation. So here's an operation. It's represented by a box. It has some inputs and some outputs. So inputs are things like, well, in the case of quantum theory, they might be electrons, photons, neutrons. So A, for example, could be an electron, and then B could be a neutron. So we have an electron and two neutrons coming in, and then here's a neutron coming out, and C could be, a neutrino. Okay, so this is the basic idea, that we have boxes that have systems coming in and systems going out, and we don't have to have the same systems coming in and going out. We can have different numbers and different types of systems. And we can represent this also by this object, by an A, which has the inputs as subscripts and the outputs as superscripts. Another thing that we have on each of these operations is a setting. So I haven't drawn it in here, but you can imagine that each of these boxes has a knob on it, which you can move to vary the particular thing that operation that you're implementing. And then in addition, and I also haven't drawn it on the diagram, there's an outcome. So associated with a particular operation is a particular outcome. That's implied by the symbol A in this box. So an outcome is maybe, for example, you have the box goes click, or it doesn't go click, or maybe a light flashes. It can flash red or blue or green. And when we specify an operation, we're specifying one of those particular outcomes. Okay. If we actually see the outcome that's associated with this operation, then we say the operation happened. That was take one. Take two, this is where we allow a kind of coarse graining. So the only difference between take one and take two is down here. And so rather than having a particular outcome associated with an operation, we have an outcome set. So this is a set of outcomes. And now, when we do the experiment and we have this operation in it, and if we see an outcome which is in the outcome set associated with that operation, then we say that this operation happened. Okay. So you noticed up here I have, in the symbolic notation, I have these integers. I'll explain what those mean on the next slide. So here, the next thing we want to introduce, the next basic thing is wires. So the idea is that we can connect outputs from one operation onto inputs in another operation. And we do it like this. And we can also represent this symbolically like this. And now you can see the role the integers are playing. So we have here B4 is repeated. This means that there's a wire going from an output on A to an input on B. So we have, this is diagrammatic notation, this is symbolic notation for the same thing. We have some wiring rules. We can have at most one wire connecting any output to any input. We have to match types. So if this is an output of type B, then we have to wire it to an input of type B. And we have no closed loops. So it's not possible, if you trace along wires through the operations, to come back to the operation you started at. This is very reasonable because these operations constitute what you might think of as a single use of an apparatus. So that's something that you use one go. And so a closed loop would be like as if you could come back to the same use of the apparatus. It would indicate some kind of closed time-like curve. You may have a bunch of boxes wired together like this and have some wires left open, some input wires, for example, here, some output wires over here. And I call this object a fragment. So a fragment has a setting. Well, the setting is just given by specifying the setting at each of the boxes. So you have to specify the setting of box A, the setting of box B, the setting of box C, and the setting of box B again. I'm going to close this door. Okay. So we have a setting. Then we have an outcome set. So associated with each box, we have an outcome set. And then the outcome set associated with the whole fragment is simply the Cartesian product of the outcome sets associated with each of these boxes. And now we say that the fragment happens if the outcome that we see is in the outcome set. What this means is that we have to have an outcome here, a box A, which is in the outcome set associated with box A, an outcome here, a box B, which is in the outcome set associated with box B, and so on. And then the other thing we have in a fragment, of course, is some wiring. So this is just a specification of where all the different wires are. A special case of a fragment is the case where all the inputs and outputs are closed. And I call this a circuit. So a circuit has no open inputs or outputs left over. One thing I should say is that all these diagrams that I'm drawing are to be interpreted graphically. So what that means is if I take some box and move it, keeping its orientation fixed, I don't want to turn it upside down. If I take a box and I move it around, then I have the same physical situation. I can stretch the wires in any way I want. And this is really just a graph. There's no physical significance to the vertical position of these boxes. So here's a few examples of fragments. So one kind of fragment is something I call a preparation. This is a fragment that has only outputs left over. So here's a simple preparation. Here's a more complicated one where I have other boxes. And we're going to associate states with preparations. Here's another fragment. So this is kind of the time inverse of a preparation. I call this a result. So a result is a fragment that has only inputs. So here's one example. Here's another example. And I'm going to associate effects with results. And then we also have a measurement. So a measurement is a collection of results which correspond to the same setup. having disjoint outcome sets whose union is the set of all outcomes. So for example here, we may have, in the setup, we may have a red light, a green light, and a blue light that can flash. And then we could have one result associated with the red light, one result associated with the blue light, and one associated with the green light. And that collection of results constitutes the measurement. A transformation is where you have a fragment which has both inputs and outputs, but where you insist, or you only consider the cases where it's used in what I call transformation mode. By transformation mode, I mean that, so here's another transformation. So I wouldn't allow this output to go into this input. So all the outputs have to go into the, all the inputs have to come from the past, and all the outputs have to go into the future when you embed this in a bigger fragment. So this is a transformation. So here's one of the three background assumptions, which I'll give you, I'll define it more clearly. So we say that we can associate a probability with any circuit. This is the probability that the circuit happens. In other words, that you see the outcome associated with box A here, the outcome associated with box C here, with B here, and D here. So the outcome is in the outcome set, I should say, associated with each of those boxes. And the probability is the probability that that happens. So we say that we can associate a probability with any circuit, and that this probability doesn't depend on anything else other than the specification of this circuit. So this is not a trivial assumption. It's quite possible, for example, that we have some other apparatus over here, and this apparatus does something which influences the behavior of one of these operations, and then the probability wouldn't be independent of what was happening elsewhere. So this is a non-trivial thing to assume, but it's sort of necessary if you want to work in this kind of framework. Okay, so I said we're going to associate states with preparations. So here's an example of a preparation. What do I mean by the state? What I mean by the state is, well, you can consider many different ways of completing this given preparation into a circuit by adding a result. So here's one, here's another. Here's another one. And there are many different ways of doing that. And the state should enable us to predict the probability associated with the circuit for each of these, for each way of completing this given preparation into a circuit. Okay. One thing that's slightly different here from what you're used to is the state tells you a joint probability. It tells you a joint probability for everything in this circuit to happen. Okay. It's not a conditional probability for some outcomes to happen in the result, conditioned on the outcomes in the preparation. It turns out that it's much easier in this kind of framework to work with joint rather than conditional probabilities. You can always, of course, get conditional probabilities just by using Bayes' rule. Okay, so we could simply specify the state by giving a probability for every conceivable circuit that we could make using that preparation. Okay, but that would be kind of crazy if it were necessary. And generally, in physical theories, we expect that the different quantities are related in some way. So it should be possible to pick out a subset of these results, so some subset of all the possible results, which are such that the probabilities associated with the circuits for those results are on any preparation for a system of the type that you're considering would be sufficient to calculate the probabilities for any other circuit. So let me, sorry? That's actually going to be one of the assumptions, yeah, it is one of the assumptions that at least there exist for systems having finite n, so finite number of distinguishable states, there exist finite subsets of probabilities, yeah. And my general philosophy is to try and avoid as much as possible the number infinity, so. So that's one of the background assumptions. Let me just go through this more mathematically. So just take a simple preparation. So this is a preparation for some system of type A. And these symbols, these small symbols, small letters, can actually represent composite systems. So this is actually a general preparation. And now what we do is we choose a fiducial set of results, which can complete this into a circuit. Now, you'll notice that the font that I'm using is significant. So far, I've been using sans serif font. Now I'm using here normal maths font. So here what we have, if you ignore the normal maths font, ignore that superscript here. Here we have a result. But actually, I want a set of results. So I labeled them with a superscript, A sub 1. And that is actually, this superscript is a label that goes from 1 up to some label k, up to some number k. So the subscript indicates the system type. The superscript indicates the which of the fiducial results we're considering. Okay, so we choose a set of fiducial results. And now we say the state associated with preparation, this preparation we're considering, is given by the probabilities for all these circuits with the fiducial results in place. Okay, so here we have a list of probabilities. And in particular, the fiducial set is, some minimal set. This minimal set isn't necessarily unique. The fiducial set is some minimal set such that for any result B here, there exists an effect such that we can write down the probability for this arbitrary circuit as a linear expression in these probabilities that we had. Here the summation over A is implied. So this is a linear expression. Now, it turns out that if you allow arbitrary mixtures, then we have to have linearity. So we're not really making a very strong assumption by imposing linearity here. Even if we don't allow arbitrary mixtures, we can certainly consider the linear case. Okay. So what we have is associated with any preparation is a state. Notice here we have sans serif font. Here we have a normal maths font. And the state is a list of KA probabilities, fiducial probabilities, from which all the other probabilities can be calculated. Associated with a certain result, which is sort of the time inverse, is the effect. And this is a list of K sub A coefficients, which you can use to calculate the probability for the full circuit associated with that result. Okay, now let's just go through a bunch of definitions. We have pure state. So mixed state is one that can be simulated by a mixture of preparations. So that means that the states can be written as a convex sum in this way. A pure state is one that cannot be simulated by a mixture of preparations. We say that a transformation is non-mixing if it preserves purity up to normalization. So you may send a state in. The state that comes out is proportional to a pure state. If that's the case for any state in going in, then we have a non-mixing transformation. Maximal sets. So here we consider a set of states. So maximal set of distinguishable states is a set of states which can be distinguished in a single-shot measurement. So here we have an experiment. Here we have a set of states. N goes from 1 up to N. And here we have a measurement with outcomes labeled by M. And this is a distinguishable set of states if we can find some measurement which has this property. A maximal measurement is any measurement which can identify which state you have in some distinguishable set of states. And then a maximal effect is one of the results that make up a maximal measurement. So, for example, for a particular value of m, we would have a maximal effect. In quantum theory, maximal sets are associated with an orthonormal basis, and maximal measurements correspond to your standard non-degenerate or projection-valued measurements. In classical probability theory, your maximal set of distinguishable states correspond to a sort of unique underlying ontological set of states. Next, a permutation transformation. A permutation transformation is one that can permute some set of some maximal set of distinguishable states. So here's a set of distinguishable states, and then here's a permutation transformation defined for some permutation. And under this permutation transformation, the state that comes out is also one of the same set of states, but just permuted. Okay. So if you have, you know, five states in your maximal set of distinguishable states, permutation transformation just permutes those states. A reversible transformation is a transformation for which there exists another transformation, which simply reverses the effects of that transformation for any state. So if you send a state in, and then you follow that transformation by the reversible transformation, effectively you just have the identity transformation. Filter. Okay, so this is a very natural concept. So the idea of a filter is basically you have a maximum measurement, if your incoming state has support only on some subset, let me say this again. So for a filter is defined with respect to a given subset here of the outcomes of some given maximal measurement. And now, if your incoming state only has support on that given subset, so only can give rise to outcomes associated with that subset, then the state should pass straight through the filter. On the other hand, if the state coming in only has support on the complement set of outcomes, then the state should be blocked. So let me just show you that in pictures. So here's your preparation. And imagine your preparation only has support on the given subset, which means that you get probability zero for any outcome which is outside that given subset for this maximal measurement. Then if you follow this preparation by the filter, then it's equivalent to just having that preparation. The state goes straight through unchanged. On the other hand, if the state only has support inside, sorry, if your state only has support outside this set, in other words, the probability is zero for any outcomes in this special set, then what happens is that this state followed by the filter is equivalent to the null state. This is a state which is a list of zeros. So it gives probability zero for any circuit. So this is really just the basic definition of a filter. If you think about what a filter is, it sort of cuts off some part of your state space and allows some part of your state space to go through. Okay, so here's a crucial concept. And I say a set of states is non-flat if it's a spanning subset of the full set of states that are passed unchanged by some filter. So imagine you have a set of states and you want to see if it's flat or non-flat. What you do is you look around for a filter and you keep trying different filters. If eventually you find a filter for which this set of states is actually a subset of the full set of states that are passed unchanged by that filter, then the set is non-flat if it spans that set of states. So, of course, you may find many sets of states which are not spanned. You may find many filters where the full set of states are not spanned, but it's sufficient to find one filter for which this set of states does span the set of states that are passed unchanged, and then you have a non-flat set. So in quantum theory, if you think about states represented by density matrices, then a non-flat set of states would be a set of states whose density operators span some subspace or act some subspace of your space of density operators. So you have a Hilbert space. You define density matrices as operators on that Hilbert space. If these operators span some subspace of that associated with that original underlying Hilbert space, then you have a non-flat set of operators. Now, we say a transformation is non-flattening if, whenever we send a non-flat set of states in, we get a non-flat set of states out. You can imagine you have some transformation. You have a set of states which is non-flat. You send the states through this transformation, and the set of states you get out may also be non-flat, but it may be non-flat with respect to a different filter. Okay. So this kind of shows you the sort of usefulness of this notion of non-flat. It's a more general notion of just having a spanning set of states. It's a spanning set of states with respect to some, you know, it's a spanning set of states with respect to some filter. Or it's a set of states which is spanning, where you can find some filter for which it's spanning. Okay, so it turns out that in quantum theory, any non-mixing transformation, such as in fact a filter itself, is non-flattening. That's not completely obvious to see that. It requires some proof. Okay, so I'll give you the postulates again on the next slide. Let me first of all just go through the first postulate, because it's actually very simple, but it's a bit of a... maybe I should say it in words first. So the first postulate is sharpness. I borrowed the word sharpness from Alex Wills. He has a paper on reconstructing quantum theory where he has a sort of similar postulate. This is perhaps a slightly stronger form of that postulate. So here's the postulate. For any pure state, there exists a unique maximal effect giving unit probability. And this maximal effect does not give unit probability for any other pure state. What this is saying effectively is that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the set of pure states and the set of maximal effects, such that it's only under this correspondence that you get probability one. It's a very natural idea. What's interesting is that causality follows from this postulate. The idea that choices in the future do not influence outcomes, the probabilities of outcomes in the past, actually follows from this sharpness postulate. And that means, in fact, that also no signaling follows from the sharpness postulate. Because if you have a circuit and you're interested in whether some choice of measurement over here influences some choice of some outcomes over here, well, you can always distort your circuit by stretching wires such that this is in the future and this is in the past. Okay, so no signaling and causality in the circuit framework where you're allowed to stretch wires and distort graphs are equivalent. Okay, so here are the postulates. The first postulate is the sharpness postulate that I just told you about. This is the one that gives you causality. Incidentally, a lot of axiomatic derivations, including my own 2001 derivation, sort of take causality as an implicit assumption, sort of part of the background set of assumptions. So it's nice to see here that it actually is something you can derive from one of the other postulates that in any case you need. That's first one is sharpness. The next one is information locality. So this says that a maximal measurement on a composite system is affected if we perform maximal measurements on each of the components. So I have a composite system. I perform a maximal measurement on this component, a maximal measurement on this component, and so on. Then the effect of that measurement on the composite is also to measure a maximal, is also a maximal measurement. A perhaps simpler way of saying this, an equivalent way of saying this, is that the number of states in any maximal set of distinguishable states is equal to the number in for each of the components multiplied. Okay, so NAB is equal to NA times NB. The next assumption is, the next postulate is tomographic locality. This is a fairly standard postulate now in many of these approaches. This says that the state of a composite system can be determined from the statistics collected by making measurements on each of the components. An equivalent statement of that is that the number of probabilities to specify a composite system, KAB, is equal to KA times KB. The next postulate is this permutability postulate. So this says that there exists a reversible transformation on any set on any system affecting any given permutation of any given set of maximal distinguishable states. In other words, if I have a system and I have some set, any set of any maximal set of distinguishable states, there exists a reversible transformation that permutes them in any way I want. And then finally, this last postulate is sturdiness. I spent a lot of time trying to think of the best name, and I'm still not sure this is a good name is different from what I had in the paper. So sturdiness is sort of a measure of how strong something is. If you attack it in some way, how well it stands up to that. And this postulate says that filters are non-mixing and non-flattening. And I'll explain why that is kind of an indication of how sturdy states are in a moment. So those are the five postulates. How much time do I have? Okay. So I'll just, I'm sorry, the one thing I forgot to say was these postulates are consistent with, this set of postulates are consistent with both classical probability theory and quantum theory. So there's only two theories that are consistent with these postulates. So if you actually want to get just quantum theory rather than both classical and quantum theory, then you have to add something. And in fact, you can add anything that is inconsistent with classical probability theory and consistent with quantum theory. Like it can be anything you want, of course. So here, I think, is possibly the simplest way of doing that, is simply to add one word to P4, to P4 prime. Add one word, add the word compound. There exists a compound reversible transformation on any system, blah, 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 blah. And a compound transformation is one that can be made from two sequential transformations, neither of which is equal to the identity. So it sort of non-trivially can be made up of two transformations. And what that does is it forces there to exist at least one state for a generalized bit, which is not part of your classical simplex. So that forces quantum theory. So axioms P1 through P5, where I have P4 instead of P4 prime, they give you quantum theory. Okay. So let me just go through the axioms quickly. Information locality, like I said, this is equivalent to this statement. This is very natural. If you have two systems like a dice and a coin, the dice has six distinguishable states. The coin has two, so the total number is 2 times 6, which is 12. I call this information locality partly because I wanted to make it sound similar to the next axiom, which I call tomographic locality, and partly because it's actually a very natural name. What it's saying is that the total information for a composite is just given to get by adding the local amounts. If you take the log of this formula, you get this one. We can imagine situations where this axiom isn't true, this postulate is not true. And although it's quite innocent looking, it turns out that it's very powerful. It's a very powerful postulate. Interestingly, in some of the recent work that's been done, this postulate was actually derived from other postulates. So in the paper of Massanas and Muller, they derived this postulate from other postulates, and also in the paper of Giulio, Mauro, and Paolo, they again derived this postulate using a sort of similar argument from other postulates. The attitude I took when I saw that was, well, if you can derive this postulate from other postulates, maybe you can do something better. Maybe you can get rid of those other postulates and keep this one, because this seems like a very natural property of the world. So the next one is tomographic locality. This says that the state of a composite system can be determined by making measurements on its parts. So here's a preparation for some composite state, and I can make measurements on the parts, and using the statistics from that, I can determine the state of a composite system. This is a very natural postulate. I can probably give a whole talk. In fact, I could probably have a whole conference on this postulate. It's very interesting. But I won't go into it in more detail here. Permutatability, I explained that one to you already. One way of reading this is that you can perform a lossless arbitrary translation of any message encoded with respect to any alphabet to one encoded with respect to any permutation of this alphabet. So from a kind of information point of view, it's a very natural property to have. Okay, so sturdiness. This is perhaps the least sort of familiar of these new postulates. So just recall, a set of states is said to be non-flat if it's a spanning subset of the full set of states that are passed unchanged by some filter. So in the case of quantum theory, a set of density operators has to be a spanning subset of the projectors onto some subspace. What it's saying is that quantum states are actually not so sensitive to the touch. Chris often talks about quantum states being, or the world being, sensitive to the touch. This is saying, well, they may be true that you know, if you touch a quantum state in some way, it will change. But actually, they're pretty robust. They're not really that sensitive at all. At least they're as insensitive as they can be under the circumstances. So if you hit a quantum state with a filter, that's a pretty dramatic thing to do to it. And quantum states bear up pretty well under the circumstances. So maybe as a sort of a metaphor, you could imagine a terraced row of houses, so a row of houses that are all connected to each other. So maybe you have houses, you know, all the even numbers, 2 through 28 on one side of the street. And imagine you come in and you have some massive demolition device that knocks down all the houses except number 4 and number 6. Now, normally, since these houses are terraced, they're built together, they would also collapse as well. Just the mere fact that they're next to those other houses would bring them down. Because you know, it's difficult to build things that are really sturdy. Quantum states are not like that. Quantum states are as sturdy as they can be, as strong as they can be under the circumstances. If you hit a quantum state with a filter, then if it was pure originally, it remains pure. If you hit a set of quantum states with a filter, if that set of states was non-flat originally, it remains non-flat. This is a sort of indication of just how strong, just how sturdy quantum states are, surprisingly sturdy. And in a sense, it's a sort of very natural property to demand that they should be as sturdy as they can be. You know, it's very natural to say this, you should have as extreme a case as possible. Okay. Well, I'm not obviously going to go through the reconstruction. This is an outline. It involves various features, like you have to construct arbitrary filters. You can construct arbitrary filters from the axioms. You can show then that there exist system types with arbitrary numbers of distinguishable states. You can do quite a lot without using a postulate P5. Of course, postulate P5 kind of comes along at the end. Okay, but I won't go through the whole thing. So I think what I'll do is I'll just jump to the end of the... maybe I can do that. Isn't this? I'll just jump to the conclusions. So this is a new set of postulates. I think it's deeper than the postulates that I gave 10 years ago. I have a conjecture that we can actually drop the non-flattening part of postulate 5. There's very good reasons to think that it's not possible to flatten without mixing, so that non-mixing will actually imply non-flattening, but I haven't been able to prove that. I also give a mathematical reformulation of quantum theory I didn't have time to tell you about. It's in the paper. I haven't dealt with the infinite dimensional Hilbert space case. That may be interesting to look at. What is interesting to look at, which probably would require you to look at the infinite dimensional Hilbert space case, is quantum field theory. So that's something definitely worth thinking about. And then the real challenge, I think, is to go beyond quantum theory to a theory of quantum gravity. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Quantum states remaining as intact as possible under the circumstances reminds me of a CBC radio show where they wanted people to call in with the analog of as American as apple pie, so as Canadian as what? Right. And the winner was as Canadian as possible under the circumstances. Questions for Lucien?
So, sorry to do that to Rob, but you say you provoked me, Lucien. Chris Fuchs would never say quantum states are sensitive to the touch, because quantum states live in one's head, and it's hard to get your fingers in there.
Good point, yeah.
And to touch them. I would say quantum systems, the things that are outside of the head, are sensitive to the touch in some way. So I don't know exactly how I would modify your language, but... my suspicion is that there's a category distinction between what you're talking about, right, and what I'm talking about, and I just felt compelled to say that.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by systems are sensitive to the touch?
No. I mean that's a tough call in a forum like this. Yeah, I would say that is a tough call in a forum like this, but it is a common thing that I've noticed that people use a language that objectifies states. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, John Smolin is a good example of saying, what is the difference between a quantum state and a quantum system? Mm-hmm. And Charlie Bennett, who's in the audience, I remember him once saying, you know, what is all this talk about quantum systems? There, you know, there are only quantum states. And so the extent to which I would elaborate it is that there's stuff in the external world, I'll call that a system, and there's stuff that is information, and by definition, information resides in the head. Okay. And that stuff is not in the external world, and I would identify quantum states with the latter rather than the former. Okay. But I learned something from your talk.
Well, maybe at least we could say that our beliefs are more sturdy than we might have thought.
Is that your postulate is seems to be sort of satisfied in classical mechanics.
Sorry, say that again?
Yeah. Your postulate seems to be satisfied in classical mechanics.
Yeah.
Therefore, how to understand in classical mechanics from your postulate?
So what is actually satisfied with his postulates is classical probability theory, not classical mechanics.
Yeah.
And I think that the natural precursor to quantum theory is actually classical probability theory, not classical mechanics, in my way of thinking. So from these postulates, you can derive two theories. One of them is classical probability theory, which is the usual sort of rules where you have a set of underlying, finite set of underlying states, and you can perform transformations that are correspond to what you call them stochastic maps on this, and so on. So that sort of basic framework.
And also, how do they understand in statistical mechanics?
I mean, statistical mechanics is already sort of quite an elaboration of classical probability theory, but I think the basic theory underlining it is the same.
Thanks. I have a remark on the first postulate and the relation with causality.
You have a what with the first
postulate? A remark on that. So everything is fine, of course. But the only concern that I would have is that the notion of pure state as an extreme point of the convex set is a notion that is somehow related to causality. Mm-hmm. Because we usually tend to associate the word pure state with operational interpretation of state, of sorry, the probabilistic interpretation of state of maximal knowledge, which in a non-causal theory doesn't mean extreme point of the convex set, but means a different... thing. So in a sense, there is a hint of causality already contained in the word pure state as an extreme point.
You could have pure states as extreme points, but they need not be deterministic preparations. They could be preparations where you know you have a box and that device only has some probability of working. It's the fact that they have to be deterministic preparations because of this postulate, for any given pure state, there exists a maximal set given unit probability. So it's the unit probability that forces the causality. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, of course, there's a causality and purity. I mean, these concepts are deeply and simply related, in fact. Yeah. Yeah. And you have in your paper, you have a theorem that says, if you can show that any state is proportional to a state which is normalized, then you have causality. And if it's true that all pure states are normalized, then your statement is immediately true. And so you could sort of think of this as a consequence of the theorem you have in your 2009 paper, I think, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe while Paolo sets up, so one other question: is it quick?